Please stand for the reading of the Gospel. Our Gospel reading this morning is from the 21st chapter of John. This is a story that is coming to us after the resurrection of Jesus, and Jesus is involved in a variety of encounters with the disciples, and this is one of those encounters with Peter. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my lambs." A second time he said to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." He said to him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Well, Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." Jesus said to him, "Feed my sheep. Very truly, I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and to go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go." He said this to indicate the kind of death by which he would glorify God. After this, he said to him, "Follow me." This is the gospel of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. So this past week, I was sort of eager to figure out a way to see a movie that is celebrating its 40th anniversary. It's been digitally remastered, a movie of my youth, a movie that I remember loved seeing, a movie that is said to have transformed the way movies and special effects are created. Anybody have a clue what that movie might be? Not Star Wars. Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Dun, 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 right? It's interesting, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, the story of Richard Dreyfuss, remember? I can't remember his name. Anybody remember his name? Or forgot. Anyway, Richard Dreyfuss is a cable worker who's living a pretty normal life in a small town in Indiana, a life that maybe he didn't really expect that he'd be living at that point in his journey, but it was his life. It is what it is. And so he was sort of plugging along until one day he experiences something very unusual, a close encounter that's going to change his life forever. Sound familiar? Well, it should, because Steven Spielberg totally stole the idea from Exodus, from the Bible. And we should be getting some proceeds from this great movie, right? The story of Moses, the story of close encounters, and in particular today, the story of a remarkably close encounter with the Lord. We're in week three of a four-week sermon series of Moses, one of the great leaders in all of history, not just a religious leader, but secular history. The man who brought, as you know, the people of Israel who were enslaved in Egypt to the Promised Land, a land that's flowing with milk and honey. This Moses is going to have to go along a very long journey. You remember about his birth while they were slaves in Egypt. You remember his dramatic rescue from the River Nile. You remember him being growing up in the palace, Pharaoh's palace, because he's the adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. You remember the day when he was an adult, when he ventured forth from that palace and he killed an Egyptian because he saw that Egyptian abusing a Hebrew slave. You remember then his escape and the 40 years that he then spent in the wilderness, now as a nomadic shepherd alongside the Midianites. You remember that at this point he's married, he has two kids, he has a decent blue-collar job, he has a Netflix account, and he loves college football. He's just a normal guy, right? That's Moses at this point in the journey. Well, until that day, that burning bush day, the close encounter of a heavenly kind, that day that we'd like to spend a little bit of time with today. So if you don't mind, I'd love for you to open up to your first reading again, or maybe you brought your own Bibles to Exodus chapter 3, beginning with verse 1. Anytime we dive into a Bible story, you probably know this, but it's important for us to establish the context, pay close attention to how we engage that story. And sure enough, this very first verse tells us most everything that we need to know about this story. Verse 1 of Exodus chapter 3 reads, "Moses was keeping his flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God." Now, we've all heard great rags-to-riches stories, and we love those kinds of stories, right? The stories of people who had nothing, but all of a sudden they have everything. But we don't necessarily like the stories of riches to rags, like of Job, who, as you recall, in Scripture, almost overnight lost his job, his family, his friends, almost lost his faith. It was a brutal few days, Satan testing him in ways beyond anything that he ever imagined. Or what about the people over the last few weeks in Houston or Florida or throughout the Caribbean who have lost so much, like the 70-year-old woman we encountered at the mom clinic, the dental clinic, just the other day? She had been living in the Keys, and the storm Irma literally destroyed her house. I mean, the house no longer exists. And so she had put what she could into her car, and she lived in South Florida in her car for a few days until finally on Tuesday she could get out of South Florida and make her way to her brother's house in Kulami. Now, all along, she's got all kinds of dental problems, mouth issues, and her brother told her about this dental clinic. And so she shows up on Friday at 11:30, but we had closed the doors at 11:15 to new patients. But thanks to sort of the graciousness of folks who were in charge, they allowed her into the event, of course, and served her in a way that literally helped to start her journey all over again. But can you imagine? I mean, overnight losing everything? I mean, far too many of those stories are being told right now. Far too many of those stories are being experienced in places like Barbuda that I didn't even know about until this past week, or certainly St. Thomas that many of you have visited over the years is hardly no longer around. It's sad, in a matter of hours. Well, in any case, that's not necessarily the story of Moses. And yet, the last time we hear from Moses, he's living in a palace. He's living in Pharaoh's palace, the emperor of that region of the world, of Egypt. And he's not just living in the palace, he's dressed in royal robes. Now, however, he's living in the desert. He's living in a tent with nomads in an area that the Bible said, did you see in verse 1? That's not just the wilderness, it's beyond the wilderness. And it's not even just the wilderness. He's now ventured to a place called Horeb, which means literally a wasteland. That's what it's become for Moses. He's living in the Sinai Peninsula where it rains around an inch and a half annually. Can you imagine? So as a result, shepherds have to continuously move their flocks from place to place in order to find vegetation, in order to find water, so that they can survive. So that's what they do. That's what it means to be nomadic. That's why they use the word nomadic shepherds. It's a land of nothingness, which is part and parcel of Moses' life, not just literally, but figuratively. Day by day, he's walking, he's journeying beyond the wilderness. That's where he is, and that's the context. That's where we enter into the story, where we know exactly who Moses is and where he is in this particular journey. And here's what's important. Into that place, God shows up. It's a close encounter, a beautifully close encounter. And what's fascinating, I think, is that it's nowhere near a church. It's nowhere near a temple. It's not in the middle of a Bible study. Right? Moses has not sought out and found God. God goes to Moses because God meets people where they are, no matter where you are. Even if you're in a very dry and desert place in your life, even if you're a refugee in a foreign land, even if you are someone who's living in a wasteland of existence, God comes to you just like he came to Moses, taps him on the shoulder and says, Moses, Moses, right? I'd like to walk through the story step by step now as we encounter this burning bush. If you know anything about the life of Moses, you know about this burning bush. In fact, in our world, we think of a burning bush in sort of almost a children's story kind of fashion, because there are so many beautiful and fun images of a burning bush and Moses either standing there or kneeling there or overwhelmed by a burning bush. What's interesting to discover is that a burning bush in that part of the world, in a very dry, hot region like that, was not unusual. It's called spontaneous combustion. Tumbleweeds or dry bushes like that would all of a sudden, because of the heat, would just suddenly catch on fire and then be quickly consumed by the fire. Now, who knows, as a result, over these last 40 years, that's where he's lived, who knows how many of these burning bushes Moses has experienced? We don't know. But as a shepherd, he's out there all the time. My guess is he's actually experienced quite a few burning bushes, which then makes me think, I wonder how many times, not just literally experiencing a burning bush, but figuratively, how many times has God tried to get Moses' attention? How many times in that journey through the wilderness has God tried to encounter him, has tried to come close to him? Maybe just as many. But this time is different, because Scripture tells us that this bush is different. The bush has not been consumed. He looked and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. And so what does he do? He turns aside. He turns to the bush. He pays attention to what's going on. He's curious, right? And boom, that's enough. That's all God needs, really. Because God knows that through his curiosity and through his attentiveness, then his heart must be ready to a certain extent to hear God's voice. I mean, God has been trying to catch his attention for, we must assume, 40 years or so. But now he's ready. That's enough. God knows that his heart is prepared. Taps him on the shoulder. Moses, Moses. But please know this. God does not speak to Moses until Moses has turned aside. Until Moses has turned aside with his full attention. Next step. God says in verse 5, "Come close," he said. "Come close to me and remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." Isn't that a beautiful phrase? I love the idea of God coming into the very presence of Moses and then claiming that presence, that place, as sacred, claiming that ground as holy ground. It's beautiful. He says, "Remove from your feet and make this place a sacred place." A fellow who lived down the road from me when I was growing up in Columbia, South Carolina, was Tommy Ishikawa. His father was a math professor at the University of South Carolina. That's what brought them there. They were from Japan. And in their home, when you walked in the home, you felt like you were walking in the middle of a home in Japan. They continued to live by that culture and those traditions. And as a result, whenever you walked into the house, you always had to do what? Take off your shoes. And I remember as a sort of a, I don't know, whether it was a cocky or just sort of a smart alecky little boy, saying to Tommy, "What, is your mom a clean freak?" Right? To which he said, "No, of course not. I mean, in Japan, that's simply a sign of respect," which is beautiful. So that's what's happening, right? God was commanding of Moses a sign of respect. Which makes you ask the question, why does God need that kind of sign? Is there some kind of divine loss of self-respect there? I mean, does he have low ego, low self-esteem, or something going on? I mean, does God need Moses to offer this sign of respect? Of course not. God doesn't need it. Moses needs it. Why? At least for two reasons. One, it helps him to understand the seriousness of that particular moment. Two, in so doing, it acknowledges that God stands with us. Absolutely. God comes into our presence. He comes to wherever we are and stands with us. But oh, never forget, God also stands beyond us. I often wonder if we're beginning to lose that sense of reverence and respect in life, in our approach to religion even. And if we do, what do we end up losing along the way? I mean, as I think of Moses taking off his sandals in the presence of God, it begs the question, what signs of respect does God command of us today? What signs of respect is God commanding of me today? What signs of respect is God commanding of his church today? Let's keep going. Then in verse 6, God speaks to Moses and says, Moses, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. In other words, I am rooted in you, and you are rooted in me. Your identity is rooted in me. No matter where you are in life's journey, if you find yourself in a dry, barren place, if you find yourself in a wasteland, it doesn't matter. You are still in my family. I have not forgotten you. You have an identity. This world is trying to tell you that maybe you have a different identity, or is trying to rethink or redefine your identity, but please never forget, I am at the heart of who you are. I have formed you in my image, and your identity is rooted in me. And then God continues in a beautiful way. Verse 7, he says, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them. Now, here's what's going on real quickly. Burning bush, right? Moses turns aside. He pays attention. God begins to speak because he knows that Moses' heart is ready. Moses then is commanded to offer a sign of respect. He does. He takes off his sandals. And so God knows that he's serious. And so that's when God begins this holy conversation. Not before then. When he knows that he has the attention of Moses, when Moses has claimed that place as holy ground, as holy space, then God begins holy conversation. And the first thing he says, because it's the first thing he always says, is to remind us of who we are. He reminds us that we are rooted in him. And then he reminds us of who he is. I want you to know who I am as well. I am not just the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but I am a God who sees my people, who knows their sufferings, who understands their stress and struggle, and I am a God who will deliver them. I am a Redeemer God. I am a God who is not going to allow all of that to sit on its own. I'm not simply a Creator God who creates and steps away and lets everything else then happen. I am a delivering, a redeeming God. Now, what happens next might surprise you, because it certainly surprised Moses. After hearing that here is a God who has come into my presence, Moses' presence, and then says to him, I am going to deliver your people, my people. Moses, I mean, his heart, I mean, you know his heart's pounding, right? And you know at that point, because he knows the struggle of his people, the Hebrew people. He knows that they're slaves in Egypt, and he knows the stress that they experience on a daily basis. He must have been jumping inside, jumping for joy that now God is ready to jump into action. So I don't know, maybe he was looking all around for the army of angels that he thought were going to come down and just sort of take over the Egyptians. Or maybe he was listening for a thunderous earthquake that maybe was going to shake up everything, or maybe, who knows, he was waiting for a spaceship to fall out of heaven and take them all away, right? Dun, 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 dun. But God doesn't do any of that. Instead, he draws close to Moses and he says, I will send you. What? Yeah. That's my plan. No angels here, no miracles, no earthquakes, no nothing. God's plan, and this is curious, is this: I will send you. I mean, Moses is the unlikeliest of people, right? He's an 80-year-old nomadic shepherd. It sounds to me like an awfully dumb plan. And yet, here's the point. God is absolutely determined to work through you. That's his plan. Friends, there's no other plan. That's it. He sees our suffering. He knows our struggles. And he expects his people to see and know the same. People often ask, what about God's response to human suffering? I mean, especially in weeks like these, the last few weeks have been terrible for people all around the world.
I mean, not just a hurricane in Texas and in Florida and throughout the Caribbean, but maybe you saw some of the images of the 8.1 earthquake that struck Mexico, the worst earthquake to hit that region in 100 years. We overlooked it because there was so much junk that was already going on in our part of the world, right? And yet it was devastating to that part. There's a lot of stress and struggle and strife and in large portions of this world. And yet also, what about those individuals, those people who face their own sort of everyday struggles? Like the 22-year-old young man who drove from Goldsboro on Wednesday, took off work and drove 3.5 hours to come to this dental clinic. First guy in line. He was to be the first patient. Now keep in mind, the dental clinic didn't begin until Friday morning, but he's starting to wait in line on Wednesday afternoon. He had grown up, by his own admission, had never been to a dentist, never knew that that was really that important. He grew up in a family where that wasn't important. He grew up drinking sweet sodas and eating junk food. That's pretty much all he did, and his teeth started to fall out when he was a teenager. He had lots of problems, and so he showed up because he knew that he didn't have the money, the resources to care for all the problems that he had. And when they sort of started to uncover some of the problems, one of the dentists looked at him and said, "Would you like to have your smile back?" I mean, this kid was expressionless. I mean, honestly, he didn't move his mouth hardly. It was as if, and I'm making an assumption, he didn't want you to see what was inside. So he had lived a life. He had figured out a way to get through life, his work, his relationships, whatever that might be, by just hardly ever opening his mouth. "Would you like to have your smile back?" They took an impression, and they formed a partial on Friday night. On Saturday morning, he had to call back to work and say, "I need another day off. I hope that's okay." They gave him another day off, and on Saturday morning at 11:30, they gave him that partial, and the kid opened his mouth and smiled a bright smile, right? Is that not beautiful? Would you like to have your smile back? And that's the point. God's response to human suffering is for us, you and me, to step up as his instruments in this world. I mean, when that happens, it's a beautiful thing. God says to Moses and to us, "I will send you. That's my plan." Then this last thing, and I promise I'll be over. You can imagine. Because if I was in Moses' shoes, this is what I would say. You're not talking about me. I'm 80 years old. I'm a shepherd. I can't deliver your people. Surely you're thinking of someone else. And for the next two chapters, Moses offers four excuses, trying to convince the Lord that he's got the wrong guy. And finally in chapter 4, Moses says, "Look, please just send someone else." And it makes me wonder, what if the Lord had said, "Okay, you got it. I mean, you just keep on doing what you're doing, Moses. No problem. I'll find somebody else." I mean, the sad part of that is that Moses would have missed out on the most important moment of his life, right? But God doesn't go there. Instead, God says to Moses, "We can't stay here. I want something better for you. I want something more for my people." And to that, Moses replied, "Okay, here I am. Send me." And it strikes me that our call from God can sometimes be big like that, and sometimes awfully small. What is asked of us is to pay attention to the burning bush, whatever that burning bush might be in our life. Sometimes it's just the whisper of the Spirit. Sometimes it's a gentle tap on the shoulder. Sometimes it's just a nudge. But to pay attention and to say, "Here I am." I have to confess that I may never have had and might never have a dramatic burning bush experience in my life. But I've had thousands of nudges. Thousands of calls from the Lord who says, "Into my life, I can't stay there. I have something else in store for you."
So that's all I got for you. What it is an encounter story. God encountering Moses and God encountering us. Doesn't matter where you are. Doesn't matter who you are. Doesn't matter if you find yourself in a very comfortable spot in your life, or maybe you have found yourself in a very dry wilderness area. God is eager to come to you and tap you on the shoulder and say, I have a grand purpose for you. And I want to be with you and walk with you in this journey. I want you to be a partner with me in the way that we are going to deliver this world. My plan is for us to walk together. And so, you know what? I have to tell you, the older I get, the more my prayer is simply this. Lord, be patient with me and keep working on me. And keep placing on my lips those opportunities when I can say, okay, here I am. Use me. May that be your prayer as well. The Lord will try to encounter you this week. I guarantee it. May you have the words that He is longing to hear. Here I am. Amen.